fleek, hating on, etc. Shitting on something is by far the most vivid. It's really on the nose. There are some really funny moments on To the Five Boroughs, and I'm proud that in a serious time, we got serious. Unfortunately, another downfall to this record is that we didn't work with Mario on it. We wanted to do it by ourselves, but in retrospect, he really helped us capture a sound and style that we really loved. A blend of all the great sounds we tried to emulate, from Black Flag to Lee Perry to Os Mutantes. We brought in Duro to do the final mixes of the songs with us, and nothing against him. He is great at making records sound great for little-known artists like Jay-Z, Mariah Carey, Alicia Keys, and so on. It's just, making shit sound fucked up, dubbed out, and punk isn't really his thing. Making songs sound crispy, clean, and ready for the radio is more his specialty. So there's a computerized cleanness to this record that makes it stick out from the others, and not in a good way. If we'd pushed the sound of this record in a more psychedelic and grimy direction, it might have been more special. The addition of computer recording, as opposed to direct-to-tape, was new to us. We'd made Hello Nasty and a bunch of Paul's Boutique on a computer, but me, Adam, and Mike didn't know how to use computer programs then, so someone else was touching the keyboard and mouse. Now, for this record, the three of us all had the same basic technical skill level, and we were in control. All the songs on this record were made using the programs Reason and Pro Tools. It can be so infuriating trying to work on something and have someone over your shoulder, breathing down your neck, telling you what to do. And it is equally aggravating to be the one standing over someone's shoulder. For the three of us, this process sort of magnified some personality things that frustrated us about each other. Yao could be so meticulous with little nitpicky edits, and then have these ideas to run sounds through different effects machines and things, that it would totally sidetrack the thing that we were trying to do in the first place. It was always fun once we got sidetracked, but in the moment, come on, this is taking forever. Mike is like Mr. Magoo. He totally knows his way around recording programs, instruments, drum machines, outboard gear, etc. But when he sits at the computer to record and edit, it's like he's never seen one before. He gives the screen this big old once-over, like, wow, okay, I see. This is what we're working with. And then we'd continue working. Real slow.
Dude, you know what? I take back what I said earlier. Fuck you, Adam.
As for me, I'm the only one in the room who knows what they're doing. If you would just move and let me sit at the computer and stop looking over my shoulder, everything would work out much better. I'm not saying that I have control issues, it's just, it'd be better if you guys just let me do it so it can be done correctly. That's not weird or annoying, is it? Another thing. The record cover is a little too melancholy. It's a beautiful illustration, but it's kind of sad to look at. I'd rather pick up Ill Communication, because I'm not sure if I'm in the mood to do all that heavy lifting. I really do like this record, though. Just not as much as our others. Right, Right, Now, Now. I sampled a Partridge Family record because the loop was great, but also because I knew it would make my sister Rachel happy to know that someone was rapping over the Partridge Family. Oh, word? Me and Mike wanted to make an 80s song. Pre-Electroclash 80s. Gumby hairdo, polka dot shirt, flashback, Freaky Friday. No one cared about this except me and Mike, not even Yauk. This song kind of sucks, but if this was the B-side onto some 45 you found at the thrift store, you'd be like, oh, word? Beastie Boys made this? This is my shit right here. All Lifestyles. Maybe this wasn't a big record for us because we did rap about very specific things like racism, an international ban on nuclear weapons, homophobia, and so on. People weren't trying to hear that. Any semblance of 80s pop music gender ambiguity was done. Metal rap was still the spoiled milk in the fridge. Fred Flintstone had re-emerged in the form of George W. Bush and Fred Durst, and America was not in a good, open mood. Shazam. Mike has internal factual issues with TV shows and pop culture in general. It's most notable in our song Nettie's Girl, wherein he sings the Seekers song Georgie Girl to the tune of Eddie Holman's Hey There Lonely Girl. Maybe his mistakes are a well-crafted mixtape of dialect, but I think it's just that he has a bad memory. In this song he says, I'm coming, Wheezy. Now everyone knows that Fred G. Sanford's deceased wife was named Elizabeth, and that Wheezy was, in fact, a living character on the show The Jeffersons. not a Sanford, a Jefferson. But he managed to bring an unnecessary sexual connotation to the lyrical mistake that's kind of creepily fantastic. So Mike, don't worry about the actual facts of these things. It doesn't matter. Being funny is way more important. Crawlspace. This may be one of my favorite songs we ever made. We wanted to make a super creepy song about spying on MCs in their own homes. Not a lot of weirdo stuff in rap, and I hope in our own way we've injected some in our time on the mic. No one else thinks this is funny. Yauk tells an imaginary MC that he looks a little chilly and asks, "Can I get you a shawl?" It makes me laugh out loud every time. The Brouhaha. S-D-I-G, so dumb it's good, was always a theme for us. Like, we wanted to make these individual 8x10 pictures of each of us and sell them on tour. We'd each pick the ugliest picture of ourselves, and whoever sold the least amount of cheaply framed 8x10s was the winner. We didn't ever actually do it, but that was the idea. The dumb idea is the good one. And so what's the dumbest old person thing you can write a rap song about? A brouhaha. This song is so mediocre that I can't remember how it goes, which doesn't bode well for its freshness. But I can tell you now that it probably has at least 7 rhymes that'll make me laugh out loud if I heard it. And I'm fine with that. A dumb idea that makes us laugh is a good one. This song is terrible, and I'm laughing as I say this. Let's put this on a record because it sucks. Awesome, I fucking shot that. What do you do when your band plays Madison Square Garden? You get a camera and you document that shit. But, typically, Yauk didn't want to do it in a normal way. He didn't ask a friend to film it or hire a camera crew. The day of the show, he went to an electronics store and bought 50 video cameras, and that night he gave them out to 50 different concertgoers to have them document the show. It's a brilliant idea. All concert movies kind of look the same. They're usually filmed in a stale, slick way. But our concert movie is really like being at a show. People are screaming, dancing, sleeping, going to the bathroom, smoking weed in the cheap seats, etc. It's all in there. The computer kept crashing during editing because there was just so much information being processed. The best part of the whole movie isn't the dynamic Beastie Boys rapping and rocking the house. It isn't that Yauk got all 50 cameras back from the nice people. It's that he returned all 50 cameras to the store the next day and got his money back.
A letter from Sasquatch read by Dave Maklovich. Dear the Beastie Boys, it was great working with you this past month. I don't get down to the city that much, and so it was really fun to go sightseeing and dine in restaurant. And I love that Island Park. It was also special for me to dip my toe back into the acting ocean. I was in a very low-budget amateur short film in the 1960s. In any event, I regret having to write this letter to you, but I feel I must. I still have not received full payment for my work in your short music video film, Triple Trouble. I also submitted 2 invoices to your accounting firm and have not heard back. I need to get this resolved so I can keep my books in order. Winter is coming up soon, and it's more difficult for me to find a place to stay during those months that meets my needs. Also, I have an outstanding balance with a local trapper up here, and fulfilling this payment will be a huge weight off of my shoulders financially. I hope my reaching out like this directly isn't overstepping or unprofessional, but I try to maintain a low profile, and I would feel repentant taking this through the court system. My wish is to resolve this amicably. Whew. Okay, official business letter written. I really enjoy working with you and that odd Swiss director. It gave me a much-needed respite from mountain life. All the best, Sasquatch.
Amy Poehler's Beastie Boys video review. Beastie Boys mean a great deal to me. Their music was the soundtrack I heard while I sat in my room, drank in the woods, and rode my bike to my dead-end job. Their music played while I learned how to perform comedy and find a seat on the subway. Their music made me finally feel like a New Yorker, and like them, I grew and changed and went deeper and hopefully got better. These days, their music makes me feel old and young at the same time, which I'm finding is a delicious space to surf. So when I was asked to write about their videos for this book, I felt a huge sense of responsibility. How do I watch and rewatch 17 music videos that span an entire career and attempt to encapsulate what is so special about them? How do I comment on someone else's art in any kind of new or profound way? How do I try to insert my narrative into the impressive Nathaniel Hornblower canon? And then I remembered, a good number of these videos are pretty dumb, so it should be easy. Holy snappers! This video rules. I think we may have saved the best for first. When I was sitting on a rock in suburban Massachusetts, this is what I imagine it would be like to be a New York teenager. A chaotic gaggle of feral youngsters jumping over mailboxes and hitting each other with sticks. I assume every single one of these young people in this video went on to start a band or record label. I wish I had a time machine and I could be in this video as a cool girl sticking out her tongue on a fire escape. She's on it. This video is so dumb. The only thing that saves it is the band is just as embarrassed by the exploitation as we are. It was always funny to me that the Beastie Boys would have these sexy girls walking around while they acted like the Three Stooges and did their best De Niro impressions. Pick a tone, guys. I do really like the number of 1980s hair bows in this video. I also think the woman is beautiful. I'm impressed with her ability to beach walk in stiletto heels. There's nothing complicated about this video, but it still confuses me. I'm not sure what Rick Rubin is disgusted by. Does he think they are being gross or not gross enough? What is she supposed to be on, Spanish Fly? This video is the first of many times that the Beastie Boys will use humorous and oversized props, or what I like to refer to as their carrot top period. Parentheses, you gotta fight for your right, parentheses, to party. Nerds, Tabitha Soren, mouth close-ups, bad acting. More Spanish Fly. Pies! Hey, ladies. Everybody's growing up. Yes, we are still going to have a disco pool party, but we're going to move the camera around and shoot this sucker in Los Angeles. I forgot how many close-ups of shoes are in this video. There's a lot of nice dance moves in this, although I feel like halfway through, MCA went to lunch and never came back. This was directed by Adam Bernstein, who also directed an episode of UCB's Comedy Central show Upright Citizens Brigade. But I checked Wikipedia and it's not on there, so I may be remembering this wrong. Or Adam is ashamed of his work with us. I suspect both. Shadrach. Shadrach is one of the three men from the Book of Daniel who is thrown into a fiery furnace by Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, when he refuses to bow down to the king's image. Pretty badass. This video is badass, too. I had never seen it, but it's beautiful. Apparently, every frame was painted by hand. It kind of reminds me of the great children's book, The Snowy Day, by Ezra Jack Keats. I would elaborate, but I just realized I have 12 more of these to go. Pass the mic. Check Your Head reminds me so much of riding my BMX bike in the freezing streets of Chicago and telling myself, be true to yourself and you will never fall. I love that bike so much. It had cool stickers, big fat tires, and I took it with me when I finally moved to New York City a few years later. I wish I could tell you I still have it, but I put it in the designated bike room in my apartment building and completely forgot to respond to repeated emails by our building super to remove it or claim it. Just recently, I asked our doorman if it was there, and he was like, the bike's from 2002? Nah. I really blew it. Anyway, this cool video seems to be the first of many times the three Beasties sing in triangle formation to camera, and it was also the first time I learned how to pronounce yowk. So what you want? Smokeweed, 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 smokeweed all day. Nettie's girl. I love you, Mike D, but I do not have time for this right now. Gratitude. The Beasties are going to play their instruments in the hot sand, and you're going to like it. I like how everyone feels a little grouchy in this, like they're experiencing the right kind of growing pains. This makes me wish for the millionth time in my life that I was in a band, and I got to look cool and play guitar and stare off to the side while the camera was on me like, I don't give a fuck. Musicians are magicians and will forever be, and I like to think that while Ad-Rock was shouting about gratitude in the desert, his future wife, Kathleen Hanna, was singing Suck My Left One in a small club many, many miles away, and then their vocal particles traveled across land and sea until it became a giant love cloud, ready to rain awesomeness on them for years to come. Sabotage. I truly believe there'd be no Anchorman, no Wes Anderson, no Lonely Island videos, and no channel called Adult Swim if this video did not exist. It hit a lot of sweet spots for me. Bad wigs, obvious dummies thrown off buildings, shots of Yauk with tape on his mouth, and then rack focus to a ticking bundle of dynamite. This song was kind of like Madonna's Vogue in that it had built-in moments for people to freeze frame and strike a pose. To capitalize on this in a video was genius, and I enjoyed it as much as my two young sons did when I just played it for them for the first time. Sure Shot. Whoa, looks like the Beastie Boys have been doing some yoga. Let's get those tuxedos on, boys. This video looks like one long selfie. I remember truly loving and believing MCA when he apologized for disrespecting women in the past and sending love and respect to the mothers and sisters. And I always loved the B-boys moment followed by the B-girls moment. I always knew I was in the club, but now I knew they knew. Cool. Intergalactic. We have more bad wigs and oversized props, but now we've added a bald cap to the mix. So, I enjoy the robot dance moves, but I was never a big Godzilla fan, so I have to admit that halfway through the rewatch of this video, I started checking my phone. Technology's crazy, right? Did you know that the camera on the Voyager spacecraft was less powerful than the one currently on our cell phone? Did you know that when Voyager 1 was launched in 1977, it contained a golden record that not only had recordings of Bach and Chuck Berry, but contained greetings in 59 languages and human and nature sounds such as footsteps and thunder and laughter? Jimmy Carter shot that shit in the Milky Way, and it's still out there right now doing its thing. So cool. Anyway, great video. Okay, I'm going to do a couple fast ones until I get to the end. Body moving. So many sets and locations. Three MCs and one DJ. Mix master. Cut faster. And he does. He does cut faster. Triple trouble. Sasquatch, y'all. Don't play no game I can't win. Dolls, y'all. And the last one. Fight for your right. Revisited. I love the idea that they can go back to their video so many years later and tease it out until it becomes a meta short film. And this vid is jam-packed with cameos, including my own. I play a disgusted patron in a cafe, and I remember asking for a red beret and meeting Ted Danson for the first time. And most of the day was spent trying to be cool and stay quiet as I hung around the Beasties, who now felt like friends. It honestly was one of the biggest thrills of my life. And as I watched MCA direct and snuggle with his beautiful family, I could only think about one thing. Why the fuck wasn't I cast as Ad-Rock? Or at least the older version of Ad-Rock? God damn it to hell. Well, at least the video ends with all the men peeing on each other, which just goes to prove you can take the Beastie Boys off the roof in New York, but you can't take the roof off of the... You get it.
In a Mix-Up Fashion by Adam Horovitz. Read by John Stewart. If your band is going to record an all-instrumental record, you should dress accordingly, like jazz cats. And so when we started to work on The Mix-Up, we implemented very strict fashion rule. Every day we were in the studio, which was 5 days a week, we had to be dressed in clothes only from the years 1956 to 1964. This is pre-Mad Men, but it was that look. If that TV show had already been a thing, I'm sure we would have opted for a different look, probably 1969 to 1973 Mandrill KG style, which was our unofficial Paul's Boutique era look. But anyway, we went on crazy eBay shopping sprees, buying all the sharkskin suits, small collared button-down shirts, ties, and tie clips we could find. Every day was going to work suit day. Except Casual Fridays. Casual Fridays still had to be in the Jazz Cat era. So we also bought a shitload of knitted shirts, bulky wool jackets, and stay-pressed pants. Remember, everything is a competition. So we really stepped up our eBay game. May not be the greatest record you've ever heard, but we looked fucking nice while making it. You guys, outfits are fucking important. Here's the thing about 94% of instrumental music. The title comes after the song has been recorded, or at least the basic idea of the song. I'm 98% sure that no one has ever said, I have written an instrumental song that starts in G minor, then transitions down to E, then has half bar horn stabs of A to B, then holds on F sharp for three bars while the hi-hat plays with conga fills and double time guira runs. It's called Bump Town, and it's about climate change and politicians deciding what constitutes a living wage. No! When making instrumental music, musicians just improvise and play whatever comes to them. Usually someone starts playing something and everyone joins in. The social and political is on their minds, and so that somehow gets embedded in the music. But you'd never know. The title of the song is an afterthought, like looking at a cat and thinking, he looks like his name should be Waffles. After To the Five Boroughs, we wanted to get back to playing instruments. It had literally been years since me, Adam, Mike, and Mark had made some music together, and we missed that spontaneous feeling of improvising with physical objects, away from a computer. We had no big concept or specific goal in mind for what we wanted to make. We just knew we wanted it to be live and direct and fun. The end result was an all-instrumental record called The Mix-Up. We'd never made an instrumental-only record before. Thought it might be interesting one day to look back at all our records and be like, all right, that instrumental one was kind of cool. So after a couple of weeks of playing every day, we decided to go all in and put ourselves in the lineage of the great instrumentalists. John Coltrane, Miles Davis, Wendy Carlos, Sandy Nelson, Lalo Schifrin, the MGs, James Last, and so many more. We tried our best to fully embrace musicianship. The time had come for us to simply make music and not think too hard on it. No layering of samples and drum machines and computer programs or rhymes to switch off and back up. We just wanted to play 48 minutes of ball and have fun. Maybe we were just tired of talking. George W. Bush had us deflated, dumbfounded, and confused. Yes, shit was fucked up. Even way back in 2006, before Donald Trump was, I can't say it. Anyways, it felt right to us to be in the studio together playing our instruments. We were happy and happy with what we were making. I'm sure in our minds, we wanted to make a full-on funky Headhunters, Meters, Politicians record. But there's just too many influences to ignore. Eddie Hazel, Greg Ginn, Ricky Wilson, B-52s. Wes Montgomery, Earl Chinna Smith, Jimi Hendrix, and Viv Albertine are all fighting for space in my brain when I play guitar. Mike Scott, Greg Errico, Pete Thomas, Ziggy Modalista, Carlton Barrett, Clyde Stubblefield, Ringo Starr, and Pete Rock twisting up his inner syncopation. Ron Carter, Daryl Jennifer, Jawabel, Carol Kay, and Aston Barrett are sending Yauch's bass-playing fingers in all directions, and Mark has an inner roll call of Elton John, Stevie Wonder, Jerry Dammers, Larry Harlow, Jimmy Smith, Jean-Jacques Perry, and Steve Naive doing the same. Because of this, the mix-up doesn't sound like any other record made by one band. It's as if ESG, Silver Apples, The Meters, PIL, The Clash, The Ventures, and the MGs recorded together and then released it through Sal Soul Records. B for my name. The title is a reference to Busy Bee in a scene from the movie Wild Style. He's laying out cash on a motel mattress in the shape of the letter B. You know, for his name. Suco de Tangerina. Whenever we're in Rio de Janeiro, we head straight to B.B. Lange's. Of course. A sandwich and juice spot that in the 60s was allegedly renamed BB for Brigitte Bardot, because she used to hang out there with Jorge Ben. Or was it Gilberto Gil? I don't know. But wherever Brigitte Bardot hung out in the 60s in Rio de Janeiro sounds like a cool-ass place to be. Bebe Lanches looks exactly like where you'd find Brigitte Bardot drinking a coffee and having a sandwich in a black and white picture. Super mod. But mostly we went there for the intensely delicious fresh juice. Specifically the Suco de Tangerina. Off the grid. When you record using the computer program Pro Tools, you usually have your music set to a specific tempo. And therefore it's locked to that tempo. On the grid, it's called. This song is not set to a specific tempo, thus, its name. It's not my favorite title, as the immediate image it conjures is someone who's quit the rat race and moved to the mountains. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But really, what I want to tell you is this. The break in the middle of this song is a catapulter, one of my favorite musical left turns we ever made. Dramatically different. Yauch interviewed a gentleman by the name of Coach Bub for his movie Gunnin' for That Number One Spot. During the interview, Coach Bub said, of a young basketball player, that his style had vastly improved and was dramatically different. And now, dramatically is your new favorite word. Right? I'd like to end this little section with a quote from the great Nasty Nas.
It drops deep. As it does in my breath, I never sleep, 'cause sleep is the cousin of death.
This is an email I wrote to my family on June 17th, 2007. Subject, Athens. Hello. So, as you know, I don't usually do this, send reports on what's happening in the world of me. But this time I kinda had to. Wow. I don't know where to start. We played last night in Athens, Greece, the city that's still rebuilding. Literally. From what I can tell, Athens takes its design from a really crappy and barren strip mall under the 5 freeway way out in Covina or Oxnard, California. Sorry if this gets a little negative at times. I got fucking sick in Barcelona and basically stayed in my hotel room the whole time. I saw a doctor who stuck a camera up my nose and down my throat and then told me that my throat looked scratchy. Which is what I told him before he put that crazy-ass thing up in my face. Okay, enough kvetching. So, the trip starts out normal. We wake up, get our bags together, get in a van, go to the airport, fly to Greece. The view from the plane is sick. The Greek islands look to be all that. As we were landing, we all had visions of meeting up with Jay-Z and Beyonce and having tzatziki and dolmades on Karl Lagerfeld's yacht. It didn't work out that way. As I said, we didn't get the glitz, we got the grime. Kathleen said that when she went, it was great. She hung out in Old Town, had a great show, and met a bunch of cool people. Oh well. We did have a really good lunch, including Greek salad, though. Anyways, the gig. The van driver guys kept getting lost and were both generally very new to the van driver guy job. They were getting us a little nervous. We get to the gig, which is outdoors and is the size of a minor league baseball stadium. Everything's going okay, sort of. Just before we go on, Bailey, who does security for us on tour, comes into the room and says, I just want to warn you guys that upwards of 1,000 people just rushed the gates and it's a little weird out there. No one's fighting or anything, I just don't really like it, so keep an eye out, okay? We get on stage and play our show. With about 4 songs left in the set, I see Bailey walk out on stage and call together a little huddle. He says, okay guys, the show's gotta be over now. They're pepper spraying people and they've set fire to the dressing rooms. We gotta go now. We say our goodnights. People are bummed. As we rush off stage, we can hear at least 5,000 or 6,000 kids screaming and it's not getting quieter. We get in a van that's waiting for us behind the stage and the van driver guy is frozen in panic. There's at least 12 people in the van screaming at this guy to drive. He's in shock. He then starts to drive real slow. We're yelling. He stops to talk to somebody. There's a truck blocking the exit and that's the only way out. Bailey jumps out of the van and tells us not to move. He runs off towards the smoky dressing rooms. Someone in the back has a walkie-talkie and a minute later, Bailey is screaming for us to drive. There is total chaos in the background of his screams. The driver is again frozen. We all start hitting him and scream at him to drive. It's totally fucking nuts. And this is just the beginning. Anyways, we drive up a dirt path towards the exit and see Bailey and total mayhem all around him. There's smoke everywhere. He gets in and whispers as loud and quiet as he can, "Everybody fucking duck down, now!" He is a Tommy Lee Jones movie character come to life. As he's saying this, we see about, 40 kids wearing black motorcycle helmets, all holding baseball bats or pipes or big-ass knives, like, for real, machetes. And now we gotta drive through them to get out. I can't believe I'm even describing this. We get towards the gate and see Jerome, our tour manager, just standing there. We stop real quick and throw him in and drive. Safe. All our shit has been left behind. Wallets, cameras, phones, money, everything. It is nuts. And then Jerome tells us what he saw, and then we meet up with the rest of our crew the next day, and the rest of the night's story is told. It goes like this. While we were on stage, only a few people were in the dressing room area. They heard some noises, then glass starts shattering. Then Jerome starts seeing these guys with the motorcycle helmets creeping all over the place. He's seeing them breaking windows with bats, throwing chairs through windows, chasing after a security guard. Oh, when Jerome got in the van with us at the gate, he said he saw tons of police cars driving away from the venue. People in our crew saw kids setting fire to all the banners, the advertising crap, setting fire to cars. One kid ran on stage and sprayed our equipment with a fire extinguisher, which, because of the wind, ended up blowing back into the audience, which set off a ton of fights. One of our crew guys, Brian, just before it all started to jump off, left the stage to go get some coffee because he was jet-lagged and tired. By the time he got to the dressing room, he saw the flames and the helmet dudes and the whole shit. He grabbed everything that he could see in our dressing room and threw it into a huge road case and closed it. Grabbed a couple backpacks that were left and ran. Right when he hit the door, he was face to face with a motorcycle helmet guy. He froze in his tracks. The guy lifted his face thing off his helmet so he could talk to Brian. He said the guy was totally casual and said, "We're not after you. We want the security." He said that while he was saying this, the kid was grabbing a Coke from this huge refrigerator, got the soda, and then pushed the fridge over onto the floor. Brian ran. There's so much more to this trip to Greece. It was fucking nuts. But I guess my favorite part was, after all that, the same van driver guy from the gig, we decided his name was Sad Sack Sam, came the next day to bring us to the airport and didn't get gas, so the van broke down on the way. That was truly one for the books. Thanks for letting me share, Adam. The Music Made It Stop by Adam Horovitz. This is a story about what happened at a gig we played in Ireland in 2000 and something. Saying it was a gig sounds so blasé compared to what it actually was. A huge festival in a big open field with a sea of like 50,000 people. And way, way in the distance was a castle. Someone's castle. The rumor was that there was an Irish prince living inside and he watched the festival every year from his throne. A prince doesn't get a throne, right? And do they live in castles in 2000 and something? I don't know. When I tell you what happened next, you'll understand why my facts are all over the place. We had a chef on tour with us, and he had a mobile kitchen, all packed in various road cases, and he made us delicious meals every day and night. It seems like a total extravagance, but it wasn't that much more expensive than buying everyone's food for each day. We probably had 25 people in total on our tour, just for our band. It was factually probably way more fucking expensive, but this chef was named Wayno, R.I.P., and he was magnificent in the kitchen. Well, this one night in Ireland, I had a little bit of a sore throat, but I had a hankering for some marijuana pot joints, meaning I wanted to get high, but I didn't want to smoke because of the sore throat. And I didn't want to play a mediocre, scratchy-voiced show with the eyes and ears of the mysterious prince of all of Ireland judging my every move from his golden throne. So I asked Wayno two questions. One, do you have any pot? Two, any chance you want to make some pot cookies? He did, and he did. About an hour later, we were all hanging around some commissary backstage communal eating zone, and Wayno presented me with a batch of freshly baked cookies for me to eat and get baked. He told me to go easy because they were kind of strong. I gave him the, okay, don't you worry about me, Grandma. I've been doing a semi-pro for a while now. I can handle my weed intake. I ate a little cookie, and so did Alfredo, Ortiz. Nothing. We hung out some more, just bullshitting, killing time, and we did the classic amateur move. These cookies aren't doing anything. I'm going to have another. So we did. The next thing I knew was that I was alone on a couch in that same room, but now my friends were moving rapidly away from me, and they were laughing at me while floating backward. Oh, no! My head felt like a punching bag, and my limbs were like snakes trying to get away from my body. I am fucked up. Just as it all hit me, a child in a motorized wheelchair zipped right up to me, completely invading my personal interspatial perimeter zone. Hi, I'm Sally. Money Mark told me to come over and say hi to you. What? I think the sound I made was as I shoved my body upright and pushed past this kid. Young Sally must have thought I was an asshole, but sometimes, Sally, that's how it is. That person in the band you want to say hi to might just be way too fucked up to return a pleasant, hello, nice to meet you. I stumbled out of the room like I was in a spy movie and I just got dosed by the enemy secret double agent. Wayno! Why? Who are you, Wayno? What are you after? In the moment, the thought came to me that if I could make it to the bathroom, I could splash a bunch of cold water on my face and that would make it stop. I was still in the espionage movie scene and suddenly I was stumbling down a fluorescently lit hallway lined with small dressing rooms on either side. And I was bouncing off the walls. Bouncing off people trying to get to their gig or tour bus or whatever people are trying to do backstage at a huge festival. While plowing through strangers, I passed Paul Simonon. Oh man, I wish so bad I wasn't like this right now. I love you, Paul Simonon. Right, Gorillaz is playing this festival too. I want to see them. Oh man, how do those two little cookies make me feel this way? This short hallway is getting longer and longer. I was freaking out. Must find cold water. I got outside and remembered that it was a festival and the bathroom was a row of porta-potties. Not a nice clean bathroom at a nice hotel, but literally a shithole. The water that comes out of the sink of a porta-potty is not refreshing, FYI. So I decided that I was going to have a band meeting. I got to find Yauk. He's an in-charge type of person and well-versed in the ways of the world, CDN serene. He'll help me. He'll know what to do. As I lumbered back down the dreaded hallway, I looked in each little dressing room that was on either side. Yauk? No. Yauk? No. I turned and looked into the next one, and there was Fredo, crouching on top of a 4-foot-high road case. He had an audience of a few people in a semicircle watching him. He was wringing his hands together in a menacing way like that creepy creep from that creepy movie, and he was saying, I want the precious, and his audience was laughing, and I was on the verge of terror tears, and suddenly there was Mike. Dude, you okay? You look manic. I do? I am. I'm freaking out. I had these pot cookies, and they got me like, whoa, and I don't know how to, like, make it stop. Can we have a band meeting, please, now? I need us all to be together. Okay, I'm here. We're here. It's gonna be okay. Let's get you some water. He led me into our little dressing room. Why hadn't I thought to just go there in the first place? Yauk was there. Mixmaster Mike, Mark Nishida. Fuck you, Mark. Did you really tell that little kid to hassle me while my trip kicked in? I'm going to remember that shit. Then Fredo was in the room, and it was a band meeting. Listen, here's the deal. I ate a couple pot cookies that Wayno made. I asked him to. My throat hurts a little. Never mind. What I'm saying is, those shits kicked in fucking hard and heavy, and it's not stopping, and I need this to just stop. I know I'm not going to die. I mean, I know I'm not dying right now. Not because of this. It's just, I'm really, really fucked up, and I need it to stop. Yauk, do you know how to do that? I know I must have looked nuts, and so I was okay that my friends were laughing at me right then. I knew that each of them had been where I was at some point in time because of some fucking laced cookie or brownie or Dutch bonbon. Yauk said that he was sorry, but he didn't know how to make it stop. Maybe splash some cold water on your face? Damn it! He said, let's go see Wayno. He'll probably know what to do. Adam and Mike literally held my hands as they led me through the haunting backstage labyrinth. Which, had I not eaten that second cookie, would have been a beautiful outdoor place to hang out on a summer evening under Irish trees and stars with my new best friend Paul Simonon. But no. We got to where Wayno's roadcase kitchen was and found him. Me. Oh fuck, Wayno, man, those cookies were really strong. Wayno. Yeah, they were. Me. Yes, that's what I just said. I'm fucked up though. Wayno. I put some hash in there, too. I told you to go slow. Me. I know, Wayno, I'm sorry. I didn't. I went fast, and now it won't stop. We have to be on stage in 15 minutes, and I am the blob. What do I do? Wayno. I don't know, splash some cold water on your face? Me, I tried that. The water was warmish, though. Does that matter? Bueno, do you want some tea? Me, tea? I don't know. Do I? Will it make it stop? Bueno, it can't hurt. Me, okay. So I drank some tea. Chamomile, Earl Grey, throat coat, I don't know what it was, but it did not make it stop. And there I was, a human-baked pot cookie walking to the stage with 50,000 people and at least one Irish prince about to witness some real TMZ shit. Jewish rapper hits the deck will be the headline. And the picture will be of me on the floor crying and pounding my fists. I just want it to stop! We got out there on stage and it was beautiful. There really was a castle way back there. And it was all lit up and it was magnificent. The audience seemed so nice and happy and excited to be in the great outdoors. Timmy Chunks, wonderful person and guitar technician extraordinaire, handed me my guitar and I put it on and instinctively went and stood by my mic in front of my amp. Mike stick counted in the first song. It was one of our laid-back playing cuts. Yauk, Mike, and Mark were playing some groove that was nice and funky. And I was frozen. I wasn't moving my hands or my body. I was just spacing out on all the space. The castle, the people, the stage lights, the summertime. Something caught my eye, and it was Timmy Chunks. He was over on the side of the stage, and he was yelling at me, "Are you okay?" It took me a second to realize what he was saying. I couldn't hear him so good, and so I was kind of lip-reading. It snapped me into real time. Right, pot cookies, band meeting, the precious, regurgitated pee water from the porta-potty sink, guitar, stage, lights, music, band, showtime. I scanned the stage to see my friends and noticed that Fredo was frozen too. He was staring out into outer space and his hands were just hovering over his conga drums. He was fucked up. But like it is with an oxygen mask on an airplane, you gotta help yourself first before you can help others. Get your shit together. I figured out what song they were playing and started playing along. It's lucky that we've played together for so long or else I wouldn't have instinctively known what to do. The next song started. Hey, I know this one. I was back in it. The music made it stop.
The Ring by Adam Horovitz, read by John C. Reilly. "Nah, man, it's cool," I said to him as I nervously backed away. "I don't really wear jewelry. Thank you, though." Then he backed me into a wall in a dressing room at the Warfield Theater in San Francisco. "But I just really want you to have my ring," he said, real creepy-like. Maybe I was tired or hungry or just wanted to hang out with my friends after the show, but this fucking dude freaked me the fuck out. He was shortish, like me, but with arms that were noticeably too long, so his hands were well below his knees. His teeth were too big for his mouth, and they had spaces between them. They looked like chiclets that had been neatly laid out on a table. And he had fully zoned in on me. Why me? Why not Yauk or Mike or Mark Nishida? I can't remember what he was talking to me about, but mid-sentence, he took a ring off his finger and told me that he really wanted me to have it. It was 1992, and he was wearing several pieces of early 90s tribal-y jewelry. Necklaces, piercings, bracelets, and rings. The thing he kept pushing on me was a silver-colored ring that had what looked to be iron crosses on it. The only way to stop what was happening was just to accept the ring and say thank you. When he left the dressing room, I put it in my backpack and out of my head. A couple weeks later, when I got back to my apartment in New York, I emptied my bag, and there it was. The ring. What to do with it? Throwing it away felt weird for some reason. I was sure that I put it on a little shelf in my bedroom. But the next day, we were all on the train to Washington, D.C. for a show. I reached in my bag to get something, and there it was. I was kind of terrified. How did it get from the shelf back into my bag? It made no sense. I must have not put it on the shelf, but back in my bag. But why would I do that? The conversation in my head spilled out loud, and I stood up from my train seat and told everyone about the dude and the teeth and the ring, and they started making fun of me. Stop laughing at me! I threw the ring down to the other end of the train car, took a deep breath, and moved on with my life. I did. I really did. Every once in a while, the dude's teeth and arms and hands would pop in my head, but it became more of an, oh yeah, remember that funny thing, than a Walking Dead kind of thing. Cut to Santiago, 2007. I was in my hotel room packing my bags to meet everyone downstairs in the lobby. I reached into my backpack, and there it was again, the ring. I fucking froze. Suddenly I was in that, Oh, no, moment of every scary movie I'd ever seen. The one where the person figures out who the murderer is, and then the murderer is standing right behind them. What the fuck? I rush down to the lobby in full panic mode to tell everyone that I found the ring. I have the ring! The ring? Remember? That dude in San Francisco who made me take his creepy jewelry from his intensely oversized limb? How he smiled at me with his fucking picket fence grill? No one seemed to care. They were all like, wow, that's peculiar. I was left still standing there with this fucking horror show in my backpack. I'm not a whatevs type of cat, and this was some fucked up shit and I couldn't shake it. There was a little fountain outside the hotel, and I went to it and had a private moment of observance with the ring. Stop doing this to me, I said, and I tossed it into the fountain, and we left Santiago. Cut to Singapore, 2007, a week or so later. It's a regular day on tour. Everyone meets up and spends 39 minutes trying to decide on where to eat. But this day, Yauk pulled me aside. Look, I gotta tell you something. I put the ring in your bag. Obviously, my response was, what? Yeah, remember when we were on that train to D.C. and you threw the ring across the train? Well, when you went to the food car, I looked around, found the ring, and put it in my bag. Wait, what? That was 15 years ago! Yeah, I just kept it. And when we go out on a tour, I usually throw it in my bag and wait for the right time to sneak it back into yours. No fucking way. I wasn't going to tell you I did it, but you seem so genuinely freaked out that I feel bad seeing you this way. I had to tell you to put your mind at ease. Cut to me now. Seriously, though, who fucking does that? Who has the prank stamina to hold it back for 15 years? I'm not only impressed by this, but I am proud to have a friend with such stealth, practical, and tactical joke skills. Thank you, Adam, for elevating the team that Coach built around you.
Equipment by Adam Horovitz and Michael Diamond. This is just a bunch of equipment that helped us make our records. 1. Hohner D6 Clavinet. This is like Mark Nishida's Superman cape. When he turns it on and starts playing the clav, he becomes a superhero. 2. Maestro Rhythm King. We don't have this drum machine recorded on any song, but we always had it around because it's just a cool drum machine to have around. Not just because it sounds great, but it also has the classic Maestro brand Technicolor Dreamcoat buttons on it.
3. ARP 2600. This thing is a beast to work with. Sometimes it would take hours just to figure out how to get cool sounds out of it. But with a combination of patience and some know-how, you could make some sonic magic. Honestly, probably better suited to a virtuoso like Wendy Carlos or Dick Hyman than us. Featured on the song, Dedications.
4. Ludwig Drum Kit. Tough to pick just one of Mike's drum kits. He has a few, and they're all like markers in time. The green one is Check Your Head, the champagne one is Hello Nasty, but the Ludwig Tiger Stripe student model is Mike's favorite. No real reason, it just is. Fun fact about Mike. He only owns used drums. He prefers the way they look, feel, and sound. 5. Acoustic 150 Bass Amp Head. Yauk's first really loud bass purchase. He got this thing in 1982 and played through it for years. 6. Leslie Speaker, the organ grinder. It has a rotary speaker that makes the sound feel like it's constantly in motion. It's like a psychedelic audio fidget spinner. 7. Korg CX3. I know you're supposed to play a Hammond B3 organ if you want that awesome Jimmy McGriff / Booker T and MG style, but this Korg sounds fantastic, especially when played through a Leslie speaker, and it's so much easier to bring on tour. 8. Shure SM58 mic. The classic. The god. 9. Galleon Kruger bass amp head. This thing is just so stupidly loud. 10. Tascam DA88. A lot of the basic tracks for Hello Nasty were recorded on this, using a Mackie mixer. It's an 8-track recorder that uses Hi-8 videotapes only. It's so 90s. It's like the 90s version of an 80s single. 11. Huge PV bass cabinet. Not sure if we fully described this properly yet, but Yauch really wanted the bass to be loud when we played shows.
And this bad boy had an 18-inch woofer, so no shortage of bass for your face. Just saying.
12, upright acoustic bass. Yauch bought his first beautiful old upright bass around 1990 at a store in L.A. called Stein on Vine. The two were almost inseparable there for a minute, Yauch and that bass. 13, rhythm ace. This drum machine isn't actually recorded on any of our songs, but Mike always kept it set up right next to his drum kit. Anytime he wanted to practice or record drums to a locked-in tempo, he'd plug in headphones and play along with his trusty rhythm ace. 14. Wurlitzer 200A. An instrument that, when played, will bring you right into the feeling of the era it was made. Play this Wurlitzer, and you could easily imagine yourself being on stage with Steely Dan in 1973, but in a good way. 15. Hondo 2 Professional Guitar. My mom and her friends chipped in and got me an electric guitar for my 12th birthday. I don't remember ever being like, Mom, come on, please, I really want an electric guitar. She and her friends just decided that I was meant to be a guitar player. Shout out to the Carlotti family. 16. Tascam Porta 1 Mini Studio 4-Track Cassette Recorder. The Game Changer. 17. Gibson Melody Maker. My most favorite guitar I ever owned. I got it in 1994 at a used gear store in Chicago. It's light and beautiful, and I wear that shit way up high, mod style. 18. Sony Variety Mic. A gift from Mario Caldato Jr., featured on So What You Want. 19. Hey Ladies, promotional cowbell. Bill McMullen wanted this here. 20. Maestro Echoplex. The sound sounds sweeter through an Echoplex. If you want something to be dubbed out and sound crazy, would you prefer to use this tape delay machine or the Roland Space Echo? It's a tough answer, right? I prefer this one. Maybe it's because it's Maestro brand, or maybe I just love how shitty it sounds. 21. Fender Deluxe Reverb Guitar Amp. The dependable friend. 22. Gibson Firebrand. My first ever nice guitar. I got it at a used gear store in the Valley in L.A. in 1991. I never wanted to play Fender guitars back then because they made me think of Bruce Springsteen, and I wanted one that looked more like something Bob Marley would have had. I played this guitar on Check Your Head and Ill Communication, records and tours. 23. MPC 60 Sampling Drum Machine. The go-to sampler of the 90s. When people first started saying, oh, that's a cool sample, this is the machine that sample was sampled on. 24. SG Guitar Amp. There's nothing special about this amp other than I love it. I brought it on tour with me for all of 1992. It has a nice built-in phase effect and a nice little reverb plate. I eventually bought a used Fender Deluxe Reverb, which was more dependable than this beat-up old amp, but this beat-up old SG amp was the one that I became a guitar player through. 25. GLI PMX 9000 DJ Mixer. Middle school rap DJ's required device. 26. Kunga and Guika. Add a little percussion and your sound is going to sound funkier. 27. Revolution Drum Machine. This thing is pretty fucking cool. I did a live remix of every rap song on Hello Nasty while we were mixing the record. I have a cassette tape of it. Want to hear it sometime? 28. Fender Jazz Bass. Mike Watt once asked to hold this bass of Yauch's. He wanted to know how much it weighed. He said most people don't know what they want. And that's why you see guys playing a 6-string bass that looks like and weighs as much as a coffee table. Which is why for years we would look at someone's bass and be like, oh, that shit's a coffee table. This Fender Jazz bass passed the test. Fun fact about Yauch, he installed a Terminator switch on it. 29. Ampeg Scroll Bass, my favorite of all of Yauch's basses. He played it with these awesome black Labella flat wound strings. It plays smooth to the touch and sounds low and loud.
And also shout out to the one Jaw Wobble of Public Image Limited, whose low-end sounds were driven by this gnarly little tool.
30. Ampeg Portaflex Flip Top Bass Amp. It's just a nice amp to play through.
And pairs so well with the above-mentioned scroll bass, just like the wine with the chicken.
31. Rogue Sitar Guitar. I bought this on eBay for $200. It's a guitar with extra strings that vibrate to make a kind of sitar sound. 32. Oberheim DX drum machine. This was the first drum machine I ever used. Rick Rubin had one, and I used to cut school and hang out in his dorm room and mess with this thing all day and night. I eventually got my own, but his was the one. The one I learned to program on. 33. Dunlop Crybaby Wah-Wah Pedal. The first Crybaby I owned, I stole from some band off the stage at the Mud Club in 1982. I never really messed with it until we started playing music at my apartment on Stanley Avenue in L.A. in 1990. Just as we were setting up and about to start playing together for the very first time, as this new version of ourselves, Yauk said, "Oh, what about that old Crybaby you have? You should go get that." So I did, and we got funky with it. 34. Univox Superfuzz. Anytime you hear a distorted bass sound on any of our records, that's Yauk playing through this effects box, featured on Gratitude, Sabotage, Being Terminated on the End of Pass the Mic, and so many more. 35. Technics SL-1200 Turntable. The one and only. 36. Maestro Rhythm and Sound. This crazy box has a bunch of weird percussion effects that play at odd intervals when you touch your guitar strings. They're unwieldy and hard to control, but it has a button on it that adds a deep, low sub-bass to whatever you're playing. And when you have the fuzz button pushed down too, you've got the Maestro. And it comes in a special little suitcase, which is always nice. 37. Boss DS-1 Distortion Pedal. My go-to fuzz box, especially for shows. It's not as cool as my Maestro Super Fuzz, but it actually sounds better. In that, you have more control over it. You can be as clean or fuzzy as you want when playing through it, whereas the Maestro is just always dirty. The Super Fuzz is kind of like the Robert Ory of distortion pedals. You only want it around for one thing, and when it's crunch time and you need that three, it's a killer. I can't believe that I just name-checked fucking Robert Ory.
38. Roland Space Echo. I beg to differ from my esteemed colleague. This tape delay and the Maestro Echoplex are both glorious machines. No need to slam each other on leather bad boys over this. But the Roland Space Echo has this magic combination of tape delay and reverb that you can manipulate with these dials, giving you a taking off for space or a slamming on the brakes into a brick wall effect, depending on which way you turn them. Plus, it is no design slouch. The graphics and colors capture the late 1960s, early 1970s fascination with space exploration. 39. Realistic PZM Microphones. This microphone is unique because you can literally lay it on the floor, and with some of its Radio Shack magic, it captures the drums, the room, and everything just right.
40. Roll of Duct Tape. You have to have duct tape lying around the studio or apartment. You might need to fix that cabinet or put some on the window to keep the cold air from coming in, but be careful. The band Le Tigre might put a piece of orange or green duct tape on your guitar cable or Casio keyboard and say that it's theirs. 41. Floppy disks. These things are kind of like iCloud, but like way different. 42. Synair drum synthesizer pad. This is on the Stoner's top 10 favorite musical instrument list. Careful, though. Don't hit your hand with the drumstick. It'll kill your buzz.
Also, I would advise refraining from any engagement with this while hungover. It's pretty touch-sensitive. So if it's whacked too hard, you just get a super loud, high-pitched disco pew sound that will literally ring your bell.
43. Emu SP-1200 Sampling Drum Machine. I was never really the type of guitar player that would hide in my room and just play all the time, but I was like that with my SP-1200. If you've never seen the documentary about objectum sexuality, go see it, then think about me in the 90s with my SP-1200. 44. Moog Prodigy. It's actually Moog, but like, I mean, everybody says Moog. Come on. I've had this thing forever, but for whatever reason, it was never on a song until Make Some Noise. 45. Roland TR-808. Oh, you don't have one? 46. A Donkey's Jawbone. Percussionist extraordinaire Alfredo Ortiz showed up to record on the mix-up with this crazy thing. When you hit the side of the dried-up old jawbone, the teeth would rattle for days.
Hornblower. Profile of a Shepherd. By Wes Anderson, read by Philippe Zidar. The boy was born laughing, literally. Sir reads an